All right. Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of Left Reckoning, your little bit of respite from the daily dystopia that we're all living in. My name is David Griscom, and I'm joined, as always, by my good friend and comrade, Matt Leck. How are you doing, brother?
I'm doing pretty good, David. How about yourself? Oh, well, you're doing pretty good, I think you just said. So I'm glad to hear you're doing well.
I'm all good, man. I'm all settled back down in Texas, so I'm a happy guy.
Yeah, David is taking Texas.
Yeah, almost immediately, to the announcement that Greg Abbott is going to continue his death drive politics, which we will definitely be getting to later in the show. We got a really fun show for everyone tonight. We're going to be talking a little bit of Ecuador, Puerto Rico, as well as hopefully a little bit of Haiti if time allows. And we might be premiering a new segment called Bum Steer of the Week, which I'm really looking forward to as well. But we wanted to, start off with some really, a really important story that has not been getting enough coverage nationally and even regionally, which is the continued crisis in Jackson, Mississippi, where folks, as everyone remembers, across the South, were really struggling with this horrible winter storm that obviously hit Texas and left millions of people without power in freezing cold temperatures for over a week. Well, people in Jackson, Mississippi, have not had running water since that storm. Now, water has been restored for some areas, but even the areas that it has been restored in, many of those areas, people aren't able to drink or use the water that they have without boiling it. People have been boiling water from bathtubs that still had snow in them from the storm, right? I just want people to understand that not only is this a severe crisis in the extent that people don't have water, but that it has been a prolonged crisis. So, the National Guard has been out providing people with potable water, and they still have to turn people away because of the high demand, even for water that people can't use without boiling first. And while services are being restored, many are still waiting. And for people who are getting those services restored, it's trickling in and they're not able to use their water again. These factors are compounding because of an environmental crisis and this water crisis that is now turning into an economic crisis, because people, especially in a city like Jackson, which has a large amount of the population, around 25% of the population, who are living in poverty. And again, remember, we're using U.S. government statistics for what poverty means, which are just ridiculously inadequate for measuring people's day-to-day experience. So you're having this, environmental crisis and water crisis falling onto an economic crisis that was already there before. But now people who are already living in difficult circumstances because of COVID and because of capitalism are now facing, higher bills and the fact that they haven't been able to work for the past couple of weeks because they can't go into work, or their job has been closed because their job doesn't have access to running water, right? And there's been a lot of takes about what's going on in Jackson, right? And I just want to highlight a couple things that are abundantly clear. There's no doubt about it that the state government and the Republican-run state government has refused to invest in the city of Jackson, Mississippi for a long, long, long time, right? That is criminal. There is no doubt about that. But we are also talking about a city that is operating on a water system that is over 100 years old. A water system, Jackson ain't a big city, but it's a city that was only around 20,000 people when the system was constructed and is now around 180,000 people, right? If it was just a question of population increases, that'd be one thing, but this is a system that just has not had the kind of investment and maintenance that is needed. But what we are seeing in Flint, in Texas, in Mississippi, and coming to cities like Washington, D.C. and Brooklyn, New York, is that the lack of investment in this critical infrastructure is going to have serious consequences for people. And the lack of investment, we can, pinpoint a lot of different factors as to why. But the primary one is that we live in a system, capitalism, that makes a decision that it wants to protect the benefits and the privileges of the few and the wealthy over investing in the public, right? why are city governments across the country not able to provide and maintain their services, right? Because city governments are under incredible amounts of pressure to slash budgets so that wealthy people in those cities don't have to face higher rates of taxation. Right. And people who are in politics have a very short term view of what they need to do. Right. Because they're just thinking about, you know, their next election. They're not willing to make, you know, the significant investments that will prevent a crisis 20 years down the line. So when we see these things, yes, they are examples of systemic racism. They are examples of climate catastrophe, all of these, you know, words that people are throwing around now, but they are fundamentally crises of capitalism and crises of democracy that bleed out of those. We will only see these crises get worse in the coming years. The only way that we can push back against them is to start being very concrete in what we are talking about. And in these instances, we are talking about infrastructure that has been destroyed through decades of neoliberalism and then capitalism. Systems that do not put people first, systems that do not democratize, systems that are constantly searching to provide the best climate for profit making and rent seeking, and not for building communities and systems that are looking out for all people. So this is a great example of why we need a Green New Deal. And what I mean by that is not just a commitment to fighting climate change, which obviously we need, but focusing too on the New Deal aspect of that, which is taking the crumbling infrastructure in this country and encouraging people and helping people work and find jobs in replacing and renovating our crumbling infrastructure. Because all across the country, and in particularly in water, these systems are at a crisis point, and decades of austerity and slashed budgets have only made it much worse.
Yeah, it really is amazing how much of our infrastructure was put in place at that time, like around the New Deal, when capitalism was most afraid. And it's obviously not a coincidence. And that was the lesson that, you know, people try to drive home about Flint, is that this is not just uniquely Flint. And this is not, this is American, this is an American capitalism problem.
Like, and the point is not to like put any of these politicians off the hook. It's to make the point that these are certainly policy decisions, but the climate that they come out of are problems of capitalism, right? Because you look at Flint. Flint had massive speculation and private interests getting involved in their water systems, right? People and organizations who their number one goal is to cut and make sure that they're doing everything as cheaply as possible, which means you're going to get a cheaper and worse off project. And when we're talking about things like a basic human necessity like water, that is not a system that you want in the hands of people whose primary motivation are cutting budgets or profit seeking.
Yeah. I mean, it's very depressing. Remember like the first time I heard about Nestle and the water supply and you know, you think about like Children of Men type scenarios that are going to happen when you're older. And no, it's like, this is just the world we live in. And is it going to affect people you love, or are you going to be lucky enough to avoid it?
I mean, I'm just saying, like, you know, I remember when I was living in Washington, D.C. and reading reports about the water system there, where the people who were managing it were saying, we have about 25 years left on the system, or not only will people face shortages, this entire shed underneath the city, our source of water for Washington, D.C., will become so contaminated that we can't use it anymore, right? And sitting there and realizing it's like, there really aren't people at the top who are taking this into consideration. Like, I'm sure they're aware of it, right? But they are making that kind of ridiculous and devastating and damaging political calculus to not address it. You know, in Mississippi, they're saying that they need $2 billion. In Jackson, Mississippi, they're saying they need $2 billion to renovate and modernize that system, right? Which is a significant amount of money. But in any kind of rational human-based system, we would have been one, provided that money way earlier to them to be, so that we're not doing it at a crisis moment like this, or two, like it wouldn't even be an ask in the sense of like, oh yeah, well you need money to make sure that the people in your city have water. Here you go. We're going to do that at a federal level. I mean, these are opportunities to do real large scale work that will benefit people's lives and will put more money into the pockets of working people across the country, right? Like the way to sell it is really easy. And we have to also make sure that when we're selling it, we're also pointing our fingers at the systems that make this a problem in the first place.
Absolutely. All right. I think, folks, if you want to support the show, patreon.com/leftreckoning, you'll get the post game tonight. Looking forward to that. I do want to stress, like, David is in Texas. I know you can't tell given his mountain background. He joined and I was expecting like to see the new place, and it's like, oh, this is a continuity, I guess. People don't like change. So
people have no, I mean, I showed up, I think around like 9 PM last night here. So I'm still very much, I'm on a outdoor like card table. It's the only piece of furniture I have in this apartment. So I didn't really have any other choice than to put this up as my backdrop tonight. But yeah.
Next week
we'll be jumping on, getting a little bit, sorry, last week, you know, it was obviously really busy for me. But getting back on the schedule with our, midweek streams and our theory reading group as well.
Yep. Okay, cool. We'll be right back with Austin Gonzalez of Machete y Mate. Welcome back to Left Reckoning. Joining us now, Austin Gonzalez of Machete y Mate, a revolutionary Marxist podcast emphasizing Latin American politics. He joins us. Austin, hello.
Hello, hello. Happy to be here.
I want to recommend everybody go subscribe to Machete y Mate. It's a sort of, there's podcasts that I'll subscribe to and think, you know, I'll look out for the episodes that look interesting. And then there's a podcast that I immediately go through the back catalog because it basically, frankly, makes me more competent at my job. And that's what Austin and the guys have at Machete y Mate. So tell us a little bit about the podcast first.
Well, first of all, I appreciate the very kind words, since we generally don't know what we're doing as far as podcasting. We are three nerds, three people who have followed Latin American politics for our whole lives, right? That is myself, my friend Leroy, who's based in Australia, and my brother T, who is also on the podcast. We are three nerds who have followed Latin American politics our whole lives, and a consistent theme that we've always noticed walking through leftist circles in the United States is how much of a disconnect there can sometimes be between the United States left and the Latin American left. And a lot of that is the language barrier, right? We often talk about on the podcast how so many right-wing politicians in Latin America are just politicians in Latin America in general, they will present themselves different in English than they do in Spanish with the intention to deceive people. So we found it important to produce English language content for leftists in the United States that analyzes Latin America from a leftist perspective in language, and not just English, but also like human language that a leftist in the United States can understand. And that's been our goal with the podcast. So
yeah, I highly recommend people go check out the current events episodes. That's the ones I've been kind of going through. It really is what you want from a podcast. So great work. One of the issues that might draw people's attention kind of on a drive-by basis to Latin American politics is Puerto Rican independence, or Puerto Rican statehood, I should say, rather. Tell me why that is not actually what the goal that particularly the left should be interested in, and give us your pitch for independence.
Absolutely. So there's a lot to unpack here. I think there's two different things I like to emphasize when I think about the political status of Puerto Rico and how leftists, particularly in the United States, should be orienting themselves toward it, right? I think first and foremost, what people in the United States should be pushing for is a proper and fair self-determination process for Puerto Rico, right? The island has had, I think six status referendums at this point. All those referendums are kabuki theater, right? It's literally the ruling statehood party or whatever party is ruling at the time putting in bullshit referendums to try and force whatever outcome they want. That's literally what just happened in November. This is why I think an emphasis on a binding status assembly is so crucial in Puerto Rico. So status assembly, what the hell does that even mean, right? The status assembly concept is something that organizers in Puerto Rico have been working on in the last few years. And how this would be structured is essentially as a constitutional convention on the island of Puerto Rico, where Puerto Ricans can decide in a binding process. And that word is key there, binding, because every single referendum that Puerto Ricans have voted on have been non-binding. Every single time. In fact, the most recent one in November, the U.S. Department of Justice came out and said, yeah, this referendum is almost meaningless and we're not going to listen to the results, right? Because they're non-binding, people don't care, right? Why would they? I think making a binding process is crucial, right? Now, that's what I think leftists in the United States should be pushing for in a nuanced way when it comes to Puerto Rico. Myself as a Puerto Rican, as a member of the Puerto Rican diaspora, as you mentioned, Matt, I'm a full-blown independentista. Not only that, I believe in independence for Puerto Rico and reparations for Puerto Ricans. Now, why do I say that, right? Why do I embrace independence over statehood? And why do I mention reparations for Puerto Ricans as well? There's reasons for that. I tell people all the time, I used to be a statehooder, right? I understand people in the United States who are, you know, progressive or liberal or whatever and embrace statehood. I used to be one of you, right? Until I learned about the history of Puerto Rico, until I actually learned about the United States' historical suppression of the independence movement, right? Until I learned about during the mid-20th century when the United States sterilized one-third of Puerto Rican women, right? Particularly Puerto Rican women of color. Why would they do that, right? Aside from just, you know, being shitty. Well, in an attempt to whiten the island, right? That's another aspect of this extremely corrupt statehood movement. You know, there's a saying on the island of Puerto Rico that this statehood party, which their formal title is the New Progressive Party, which there's nothing new or progressive about them. You'll hear that one a lot. But the thing people say about the statehood party is that they're essentially a criminal organization. And it is literally good old boys like corrupt politics with the statehood party. The statehood party's delegate to Congress ran Trump's campaign on the island, is a fervent Trump supporter. People's brains explode when I tell them, oh yeah, there's plenty of Trump supporters in Puerto Rico, right? People always say to me, well, what about the hurricane and the response and everything? Yo, there is a deep self-hatred within the statehood movement in Puerto Rico, right? Within different sectors of the island of Puerto Rico and in Latin America broadly because of, you know, the white supremacist culture that, you know, we live in the world, right? There is, I think it's just really important to think about kind of going back to independence over statehood, right? I think it's important to look at it from an internationalist perspective as well, right? I think that's really important for socialists. I think a state, of Puerto Rico, right? A permanent colonialism is how I would define that. And not just that, but a permanent U.S. base in the Caribbean mm-hmm. to do whatever the hell they want to Cuba, to Venezuela. I don't know if people remember the during the beginnings of the Guaido push, right? The attempted Venezuelan coup, which I guess they're still attempting, apparently. Jesus Christ, Biden, yeah. right? I remember during the beginnings of that, there was it would be funny if it weren't so sad. There was a moment where the governor of Puerto Rico at the time, he was eventually had to resign in disgrace. That's all another thing. He sent like a boat or something like that from the island of Puerto Rico to Caracas to like kind of like add pressure. Some people might not realize this. Venezuela is the closest continental landmass to Puerto Rico, right? Closer than the United States. Not that they're super close, but relatively speaking, it's closer. And that's an important thing to think about as well when I think about socialists orienting themselves toward Puerto Rican independence. This is not a civil rights issue, right? That's what the statehood party and the stateholders will try to say. They'll try to say it's a statehood, they'll try to say it's a civil rights issue, which DC statehood most certainly is a civil rights issue. Puerto Rico, this is a human rights issue, right? This is about international law. Every year, the UN's decolonization committee puts out a report saying, hey, yeah, it's kind of fucked up what's happening in Puerto Rico. We should probably like give them independence or something. And every year the United States ignores it. So once again, I think internationalism is a big aspect of that. And that's why I got the black flag behind me as well, because I'm a bleeding heart independentista. So.
Well, could I ask you too, in the divisions between, you know, people who are pushing for independence versus statehood, you know, is there a class analysis there that you're able to make? Or is it sort of divided equally amongst, like, you know, working class and wealthier people in Puerto Rico?
It depends. It's complicated. Mm-hmm. I would say you would find it on you. It's very wide range mm-hmm. among the sectors, right? I'd say the statehood party definitely has like the political machines in Puerto Rico, so to speak, behind them, or I guess they themselves are a political machine in San Juan. Like the political elites, I guess, is more the phrase I'm looking for, right? There were like political dynasties and shit like that. I think there is certainly a base of working class support for statehood in Puerto Rico. And one of the biggest reasons for that is, well, there's a couple reasons. One, the historical suppression of the independence movement. I think it's impossible to talk about the prominence of the power that the statehood movement has in Puerto Rico without talking about the intentional suppression of the independence movement that happened in the last 100 years. Even just in our lifetimes, it was 2005 that Filiberto Ojeda Rios, who was like the leader of like the Puerto Rican independence guerrilla movement at the time, was just killed by the FBI in his house when he was like doing nothing. And it was a big controversy at the time. So things like that still happen. But yes, another reason that there's working class support for both independence and statehood in Puerto Rico is I go back to that self-hatred, right? Mm-hmm. This idea that, oh, come on, we're Puerto Ricans. Us running a country, we can't do that. Mm-hmm. We need the United States. Come on, they're going to give us the economic benefits. I would say, you know, to talk to Michigan and Mississippi about how that's worked out for them.
We were just talking about that, yeah.
Exactly. Ask them about the benefits of statehood, right? I, of course, favor not only independence, but Caribbean integration, right? Mm. I don't like it. Blows my mind that you can't just take like a ferry from San Juan to Santiago, Cuba. That's like literally against the laws of nature in my mind that you can't do that. That's mind boggling to me. I hope that answered the question.
No, that's great. I mean, I think that Caribbean integration angle sounds also interesting because it seems like for something like independence and reparations, it would need to be along with some of the other Caribbean states. Mm-hmm. I mean, Latin America in general. But yeah, I mean, Ivan, talk a little bit about us about Caribbean integration, maybe.
Absolutely. So Cuba in particular, I should start with Cuba and Puerto Rico. Cuba and Puerto Rico have strong, deep historical and cultural ties. Now, why is that, right? Aside from just being in Spanish-speaking, you know, nations in the Caribbean. Well, for any of my history nerds out there, Cuba and Puerto Rico remained colonies longer than all the others, right? Up until 1898, when the United States annexed Puerto Rico and essentially turned Cuba into a protectorate with things like the Platt Amendment, right? at that point, Cuba and Puerto Rico functionally, they were like the same country, right? They were both like the Spanish. They were the last outposts of the Spanish Empire in the Caribbean. So there's deep ties there. There's a saying that Cuba and Puerto Rico are two wings of the same bird, right? That's kind of like a saying that leftists use in Cuba and Puerto Rico. There's a great Fidel Castro quote that I love to use, right? Which is something to the effect of, as long as there's one Puerto Rican that supports independence, it's a moral duty for us to support it as well. Something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of an example of the deep ties between Cubans and Puerto Ricans. But more broadly, I'd say my like ideological father, when I think about Puerto Rican politics, and I think you'll hear this from a lot of modern day independentistas, is a man named Eugenio Maria de Hostos, right? He was a famous Puerto Rican educator. He had during like the late 19th century, right up and to the U.S. annexation of the island. Hostos really pushed the idea of what he called an Antillean confederation, right? Basically a united Caribbean. Hostos was a prominent educator, not just in Puerto Rico. He did a lot of work in the Dominican Republic, did a lot of work in Chile as well, I believe. One of my favorite things about Hostos, right? Because he did so much in the work in the Dominican Republic, when he died, he said, "I want my bones buried in Santo Domingo until Puerto Rico is free. Then I want my bones transferred back to Puerto Rico." Wow. So to this day, one of Puerto Rico's most famous historical figures is buried in the Dominican Republic. So there's deep ties across the Caribbean. It's once again, what makes me even more mad, like with everything that's going on in Haiti, I know the president of the Dominican Republic, Luis Abinader, was talking about like, oh, maybe we should do a border wall. Like, Jesus, what the Caribbean needs is less border. What the world needs is less borders, right? Less borders, less border walls.
Absolutely. Well, let's move to Ecuador now, I think.
I think this is something that, you know, we're trying with this project too, is to build those connections in, at least, you know, in the first step between like the U.S. left and, you know, left-wing politics in Latin America. And like the first step is awareness. And we've been trying to cover what's been going on in Ecuador. Right. And I would be very interested if you were able to, because I know a lot of our listeners are already familiar, but if you could give us, you know, a brief history of Correa so we can understand the dynamics of this election, and then we can move into, you know, Lenin, Moreno, and what happened there. And I always have to say, one of the great like ironies of history is that a man named Lenin, who it was not an accident, was purposefully named after Lenin, turned out to be such a traitor to like left-wing movements. But we'll get to...
And yo, his name is Lenin Moreno, which would translate to English as like the brown Lenin, which, holy shit, that sounds awesome, but evidently not. Oh my goodness. Okay. So I'll try and be relatively brief here, because Ecuador is a big, 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 there's an escalating situation there right now. Yeah, right. Exactly. So Rafael Correa was elected in 2007, right, on a anti-establishment, anti-IMF platform, right? Ecuador, like most countries in Latin America, like most countries in the third world, had a significant amount of debt to the IMF. Right. Just an odious amount of debt. Rafael Correa, after he was elected in 2007, he was able to successfully reduce bondholder debt in Ecuador by literally arguing against the IMF in court, and was successful. So it put Ecuador on a path to economic growth, right? The economy grew a lot during Rafael Correa's term. It also put Ecuador on the path of regional integration. Rafael Correa associated himself with some people might call them the 21st century socialists, or the Bolivarians, perhaps, right? Mm-hmm. Venezuela, Bolivia, Cuba, and Nicaragua at the time. This was important for a lot of reasons, right? For, I think when talking about Ecuador, another really important thing to think about is, what is Ecuador, right? You know, I think to people in the United States, it's easy to look at Ecuador as, oh yeah, it's that country, that small country on the equator, right? This is basically, it's all Hispanics. It's obviously a lot more complex than that, right? Ecuador itself is a country with a deep, deep indigenous history, right? Quito, the capital of Ecuador, was one of the historical capitals of a part of the Incan Empire, right? So there's a really deep indigenous culture there, and there's a really strong indigenous movement there as well. I think that's an important thing to think about, because when Correa brought Ecuador kind of into this 21st century fold and embraced integration, right, it is no mistake that the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR, which was like kind of like a regional bloc they were forming, was capitaled in Quito, right? For historical reasons, for geographical reasons, you know, things like that. And that's, you know, that's why I think it's important to remember for leftists in the United States, it might be easy to think that, oh, well, what does the United States care about Ecuador, right? Isn't Venezuela the golden goose, right? Ecuador was a crucial part of this puzzle, which is why we're seeing kind of like the, I would describe it as a hit job that's going on right now. But I guess we'll get into that a little bit more.
Yeah. I think it's important to like note, especially like with any potential, for example, of like South American integration, like how critical, Correa was to that movement as well, to understand that it's not just like, these aren't just like for leftists, for socialists who are listening to this. We're not just talking about like, okay, we want like our people in power because we want our people in power in every country. Like you have to understand like these were parts of, you know, historical movements that came really close to being able to implement a lot across not just their own countries, but the continent as a whole. And that's why we've been facing, you know, you've been seeing what's been going, obviously what's been what happened in Brazil with Lawfare and with Bolivia. Like there's been all this, you know, Lawfare against these kind of left-wing candidates. And it's because they were very afraid of there being a cross-continental left-wing movement coming into power. And so let's get to this key figure here with Correa, though, too, because Correa's successor, Lenin Moreno, was supposed to continue this project. And then, as I'm sure you'll be able to explain eloquently, didn't, and then ended up becoming essentially a servant of neoliberal capital, most famously for most folks, betraying, Assange, as he did recently.
Which also, I should have mentioned Assange too. That's probably one of the biggest things that Rafael Correa is notable for, giving Assange asylum. But yes, oh my goodness, if there's one big criticism, or if there's probably the biggest criticism I have of the Correa presidency, it's clearly not properly vetting your successors, right? Evidently. Here's the thing that I will say, I guess, in Correa's defense here. Lenin Moreno, first of all, like we said, his fucking name's Lenin, right? That's just, come on. We assumed he was good. But Lenin Moreno, he ran as a Correista, right? He ran his campaign as, no, I'm Correa's, I'm the successor, blah, blah, blah. That's how he ran his campaign. But as you described, you know, to say he made a 180 like is almost an understatement. I have developed this conspiracy theory that Luis Almagro, the Secretary General of the OAS, he either has Moreno's nudes or some sort of blackmail on him and was like, yeah, you're going to listen to us now. Like, it's amazing to me how much his reversal was. So what did Lenin Moreno do, right? I'd say probably like the word I use that I think is most effective in describing Lenin Moreno is betrayal, right? Betrayal of Julian Assange, as you just described, right? Bowing to the U.S. pressure and saying, yeah, okay, cool. We don't really care about Julian Assange anymore. We'll remove his asylum. Betraying the people by accepting a $10 billion IMF loan, right? Which was particularly egregious to the Ecuadorian people since literally, like I said, Correa's his biggest claim to fame was negotiating down the bondholder debt of the IMF, right? Mm-hmm. So to see Lenin, and we saw this with the Bolivian coup government too, right? What was one of the things they did before they left? Oh, give us an IMF loan so we can make sure the leftists can't do anything with the economy. Mm-hmm. Though they returned that, but that's a whole nother thing. So it was particularly egregious for the Ecuadorian left to see Lenin Moreno doing this for many reasons. Now, what that the acceptance of that loan did lead to was a massive protest uprising in Ecuador in late 2019, right? It was late 2019. And it was because Lenin Moreno had declared the abolition of fuel subsidies, which this was something that the IMF was requesting. Massive protests broke out in Ecuador. Massive protests protests backed by the indigenous social movements. It was so bad for Lenin Moreno that he literally had to flee the capital and go to Guayaquil on the coast, right? One of the coastal cities, because they were literally afraid that Quito was going to fall to I guess an indigenous revolution, right? Wow. So Lenin Moreno had to backtrack, right? Luckily, and did at least on the fuel subsidies, right? But that to me was the beginning of the end of the Lenin Moreno regime, right? In the beginning of the resurgence of the Ecuadorian left because of that massive protest movement. That was when you first saw or not first saw, but that was the beginning of kind of the prominence of people like Yaku Perez, who I know we're going to be talking about, and Patrick Kudyk, and obviously Andres Arauz and the Coreistas as well. But when I think about Lenny Moreno, I go back to that one word, betrayal. Like, yeah.
Yeah, and I highly suggest, I listened to a really good interview with Guillaume Long, who was in the Korea government as well, that he did with Grace Blakely, who we've had on the show as well. And it was talking about the successes of the Korea movement. But one thing that we've been doing on this show, and I think it's really important that we start to do as like a global left, is take stock of what happened with what we could maybe call like left populism, right? Because the Korea movement was really exciting because it was very left wing and it was moving a lot of, you know, social programs that were very much needed. But it did have a kind of like big tent appeal, right? And as Long was saying, in his discussion with Blakely, it's not a condemnation of like what was done and what was achieved. It's like the lessons that you learn, that when you create a big tent, that you also are even including some people who have like economic interests that are, you know, opposed to the workers. And you have a lot of people who want to come into the movement because like, oh, this is the party that's in power. So if I want to come into power, this is the group that I need to attach myself to. You know, you have to, like, I think one of the biggest lessons that we're learning for like left-wing parties across the globe right now is making sure that they're not just to, you know, to borrow the phrase from Leo Panish, who's somebody we've been talking about a lot on the show too, aren't just class focused, but class rooted. But anyways, we could put a pin on that till later, because I really wanted to talk about, you know, the election that's going on right now, because it does seem like we could see a resurgence of the Korea project, but there have been some very, very, honestly, to be frank, strange accusations that we've been seeing, and potential alliances between, you know, an indigenous left and, you know, more right-wing candidates there as well. So,
sure. Yeah. So it's, to say the situation is complicated is an understatement,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I think that's the first thing that I emphasize with this situation, this election. It's not black and white, right?
Yeah.
It is not one layer of it is black and white. Mm-hmm. I think the first thing to point out and be very clear about is that since day one, when this election was, when people were gearing up for this election, the right wing has tried to sabotage the Correistas since day one. They successfully banned Rafael Correa from running for vice president because he was supposed to be on the ticket with Andres. They banned, I think, two different political parties that they tried to register as until they were finally able to register as the Union for Hope, right? So they've been under attack from the electoral from the government in Ecuador from the beginning. So I think that's very important to point out. Despite all that, Andres Arauz was polling well and was favored to do really well because of how bad Lenin Moreno, how bad of a job Lenin Moreno had done, right? I, perhaps riding on the wave of optimism from Bolivia, right, because of how inspiring that was, I thought it was a shoo-in that Andres was going to win in the first round. I thought it was a guarantee. I thought it was, oh yeah, this is going to be in the bag. More and more, I'm very disturbed when I think about the super secret meeting that Lenin Moreno had with Luis Almagro, the head of the OAS, a week before the election, right? That's a little disturbing to me, for obvious reasons. I think about, and granted, this is an election under COVID, so, you know, I understand it, but I think about the long voter lines. I think about kind of the different voter suppression tactics that clearly took place in Ecuador. But with all that said, I think it's also important to point out that election observers have clearly stated time and time again, there was no fraud, right? Mm-hmm. There was no actual election fraud, right? Now, I think that's extremely important to point out because of how the situation has kind of developed, which is on election night, as Andres was polling, or was the results were filtering in, and Andres was clearly in the lead and getting close to maybe avoiding the runoff, but it was seeming more and more that there was going to be a runoff. Initial reports were showing that Yaku Perez, who was the candidate from the indigenous Patrick Kudyk party, might end up actually going into the runoff with Andres Arauz, which was particularly surprising to a lot of people, right? He kind of like an insurgent. Yaku would describe himself as an insurgent environmentalist candidate, but we'll go into that in a second here. Yaku Paris was looking to get ahead of the neoliberal candidate Guillermo Lasso, who they were neck and neck, though. They were neck and neck for second place to see who was going to go into the runoff against Andres. The election observers that I know, the people I know in Ecuador, who I'm going to have to shamelessly plug the Machete Mate interview that we did with one of the election observers. The election observers I know in Ecuador told me, literally before the results were even coming out, they told me, according to their data, they are very confident that Lasso is going to pull ahead of Yaku Paris because the coasts come in late, right? Mm-hmm. Yaku Paris having a lot of support in the highlands, right? Since that's where the indigenous are. From before anything even happened, they were telling me this, right? Because it was clear just from the data. So when Lasso ended up pulling ahead of Yaku Paris kind of toward the end there, it wasn't surprising to me. It wasn't surprising to anybody who was actually following. Mm-hmm. But Yaku Paris claimed fraud, right? And is continuing to claim fraud. So I think it's really important to think about and ask ourselves, who is Yaku Paris and who are Pachakutik, right? Because I think those are really important questions here. And I think they should be differentiated, right? Mm-hmm. I think for me, I'm going to be completely honest. Everything I've seen tells me that Yaku Paris is an opportunist, that Yaku Paris is a fraud. Yaku Paris never saw a right-wing coup that he didn't support. Yaku Paris never saw a left-wing government that he didn't call uniquely corrupt, right? Now, because I believe Yaku Paris is an opportunist, do I believe that Pachakutik and the social movements behind him are opportunistic? No, certainly not. Certainly not. Pachakutik was the party that Yaku Paris ran with, was founded in 1995 as essentially the political party arm of CONAIE, right? What is CONAIE? CONAIE is the Confederation of Indigenous Organizations in Ecuador, right? This is essentially the indigenous lobby for all intents and purposes. Mm-hmm. CONAIE has existed since the mid-80s and has a reputation in South America as one of the most militant, one of the most well-disciplined, one of the most well-organized indigenous organizations on the whole continent, right? So CONAIE they're an amazing, once again, an amazing disciplined group of people, environmentalists, plurinationalists, socialists, right? They've always embraced socialism. I think after the 2019 protests, that's right, where Yaku Paris kind of gained in prominence. That was one of the biggest reasons that he was kind of able to get enough support within Pachakutik to run for president, right? Mm. I think another thing to point out that's really important, which is kind of twofold here, is that one, Pachakutik is indigenous. Pachakutik does have a base in the indigenous communities. That does not mean that Andres Arauz and the Union for Hope don't, right? Mm-hmm. They also have a strong indigenous constituency. They also have a strong indigenous base. They're also plurinationalists, which is why I think Andres Arauz himself has had some of the best rhetoric or the best responses to all of this, right? Mm-hmm. Which is Andres Arauz has consistently tried to make overtures to Pachakutik and Yaku Paris, or at least in the early stages when things were not as frosty, I guess, or as hot, I should say, as they are now. Andres consistently would say, I think we should be celebrating that the Ecuadorian people voted 70% in favor of plurinationalism and 70% against neoliberalism, right? Mm-hmm. Basically saying, hey, Pachakutik, Yaku Paris, we are natural allies. Like, how can you possibly even consider going into coalition with the neoliberals and with Guillermo Lasso? Which is why the second thing I think is important to point out when thinking about Pachakutik and CONAIE is that they're divided on this, right? Mm-hmm. There is raging debate internally over how to orient themselves toward the runoff, right? Because the indigenous communities, they're not stupid, right? Yeah. They don't need academics or U.S. leftists or whatever saying to them, oh, well, actually, you don't know this. This is how things are supposed to be. They know what's happening, right? They're aware of the situation. And the radical sectors within CONAIE have been very public in saying, no, we will not coalition with Guillermo Lasso. That's not going to happen. So I think those are really important things to point out. And like I said, fundamentally, it's not black and white. It is a very nuanced situation.
No, and I really appreciate you, doing that work to disentangle, for example, Perez and like the indigenous movements, because I think that it's that conflation between the indigenous movements and Perez in general has led to some kind of like sloppy analysis from even like left wingers who are trying their best to understand the situation. Like, I just have to say, people should be like aware that like Perez, this is somebody who like celebrated when Lula was thrown in prison. This was somebody who celebrated the coup against Evo Morales, right? This is not somebody, who, is just like, against Correa or like some very specific, like Ecuadorian case. This is somebody who is adamantly against left-wing governments, regardless if they are, people like Lula or people like Evo Morales, right? And I think that that's an important thing to note. I want to make sure that we don't miss this part of it as well, because the reason that we're fixating on this is because all of these claims of fraud only amplify and the possibility of some kind of intervention, be it clandestine or overt, against a return to for Arruz to win the election. And I also want to note, Moreno is continuing his neoliberalization of the country of Ecuador. He is continuing to try to privatize more and more of the state bank in Ecuador, right, which is increasingly damaging. So if you're able to basically push this election down the line like they were successfully able to do in Bolivia, you can do a lot more damage and continue to privatize more and more and more of the country to implement that agenda, essentially, through some another form of basically of lawfare. Like if they're able to continuously hold these results like in the courts or something like that, that's something that's extremely dangerous. So it's like this, the role that Perez is playing right now, even if they don't end up aligning themselves with the right wing in the runoff election, they are doing a lot of groundwork for people who want to do a lot of damage in Ecuador.
Absolutely. And I'll steal a quote that I referenced in an interview that my podcast did with an election observer. He said, from his perspective on the ground, it's death by a thousand cuts, right? Mm-hmm. Obscure the process. Oh, well, there was fraud. Oh, well, there's also voter suppression, which is legitimate, right? Obscure, obfuscate things, because you're exactly right, David. To me, that's their intention. Delay the election. That's mm-hmm. what they're trying to do. Either get Arauz off the ticket entirely, right? I think that's literally what they're trying to do mm-hmm. by accusing Arauz of being in bed with Colombian guerrillas, which holy hell, that's a whole
Did you hear about the bird thing with that? Sorry.
I did. Yeah. That's amazing. What is it? Like a bird analyst said that the bird in the super secret gorilla video wouldn't even be in Colombia. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Here's what's amazing. That's just the typical kind of clown show shit that I expect from the right wing in Latin America, right? Like mm-hmm. that's the kind of shit they'll do. Just, hey, Arauz, he's actually getting paid by gorillas that were financed by the Progressive International. Mm-hmm. Just the most outrageous shit that no rational human being would ever even contemplate. Mm-hmm. But I do worry. I do worry that they're going to, I don't know if they'll be successful in getting Andres off the ballot, right? Because he literally came in first by almost 10 goddamn points, right? I think they're going to keep trying to push to delay it. We'll see what happens, but it's definitely a situation that people got to keep their eyes on, because that's what they're going to try to do. They're already trying.
You've kind of already mentioned it, like the importance of Ecuador, but I want your take on like sort of the left versus right in Latin America broadly, particularly if Arauz wins. And like, for instance, like pick the pink tide, is that terminology? Is this like a second coming of the pink tide? You mentioned Bolivarian revolution. Like what sort of terms are you using to describe what you're seeing? And I mean, yeah, I guess go over the significance again, if we can actually land Arauz in.
Sure. So the thing that I like to emphasize about the pink tide is that for me, this idea, and I used to say this back in the day on the podcast, this idea that the pink tide, the right wing won, we've beaten them back, to me, that was always ephemeral, right? That was always just a media narrative. And why do I say that, right? It's not like right-wing governments weren't taking power. They absolutely were. The reason I say it was ephemeral and a manufactured media narrative is because the bases are still there. Like, look at Bolivia. Yeah, you can coup Evo. The base is still there, right? Yeah, you can declare Guaido president. That doesn't just make the communes and colectivos go away, right? Mm-hmm. The base is still there, which is why I've always been very confident that the left would bounce back, even when things got at its darkest, right? When Bolsonaro was on the rise, and which, God, his days are numbered. You mark my words, right? Mm-hmm. To me, that was always just a manufactured narrative of, oh, haha, the right wing's coming back. You see the Bolivarians, they didn't know what they were doing. They were all just corruptos, right? Let's get rid of them. And I think you're beginning to see the manifestation of, once again, how not true that narrative was, right? You know, Bolivia is the most visceral, clearest example of that, right? Because once again, the social movements in Bolivia were critical to getting MAS back in power. MAS itself is a product of the social movements, right? Mm-hmm. I described earlier the process of how Pachakutik was founded as kind of like the political arm of CONAIE. MAS, very similarly in Bolivia, MAS is literally referred to as the political instrument of the people, right? That's how they view it, because the social movements control the party, right? And I think that's a particularly important point to bring up in Ecuador as well, right? You asked me if I think, or you mentioned, you know, will Arauz win, right? If we see Arauz versus Lasso one-on-one and it happens when it's supposed to, I think Arauz will win, right? I do think Arauz will win. If he wins, and here's why I love Arauz, because I think he knows this better than anybody. If he wins, it's clear to me, should be clear to everybody at this point, the Ecuadorian left needs to do a better job at building bases within the indigenous community, right? Mm-hmm. I'd say that's extraordinarily clear. And once again, I think Andres recognizes that. I go back to what Andres has been saying. David, you mentioned how some people within the leftist sphere have kind of like had a bad interpretation of what's been going on in Ecuador. Mm-hmm. And you're right. And it disappoints me, because let's just look at what Andres is saying. Let's look at what he is saying, because he's had so much better and smarter rhetoric than I've seen from a lot of people commenting on it, right? Which is, no, we should be working with CONAIE, right? We want to build, we are opposing neoliberal extractivism too, right? It's about investing in our communities. And I think that's really important. I think if the Ecuadorian left is going to persist, that's crucial, right? Getting those social movements behind them and really establishing links, because that is what gives you the opportunity to resist things such as the coup d'etat in Bolivia, right? And I think that's really important. You like the social movements in Bolivia, in Venezuela, they're so deep. Even in Brazil, right? The landless workers movement, they're crucial to the anti-Bolsonaro resistance right now, right? And that's another big reason why I say Bolsonaro's days are number two, right? So I think there's two big things that I would tell U.S. leftists to keep their eyes on. Number one is Chile, right? Chile, which is having a constitutional referendum soon, which, holy shit, that's going to be amazing if they approve a new constitution.
For sure.
In fact, random side note, polling just came out from Chile with Daniel Jadue, the Communist Party candidate, in first for the presidential elections. Now we're a little ways away.
I was about to say
there's certainly some dominoes that need to fall, but damn, that's just mind blowing in and of itself. So Chile, I would say to keep your eyes on. And once again, I go back to Brazil. Wouldn't be the first time a president was forced to resign in Brazil, right? So who knows?
Yeah, I mean, what Bolsonaro has done in power, especially in response to COVID, has just been so despicable. And it's clear, even if you were somebody who was just a nasty dinosaur right winger, it's like, this is not even the guy who you want to be, you know, doing it. Because at first he was like, oh, this guy is so gauche, and like he says this thing that everybody wants, you know, that kind of like nasty kind of perspective. But like now he has exposed himself as just so incompetent that even if you want him to be the strong arm of fascism or right-wing politics in Brazil, their support is dwindling too.
Exactly. And what I say as well is, hey, Dilma got impeached for less. Dilma got impeached for way less.
What's that about? Yes.
Austin, give us your contact info so people can follow your work.
Absolutely. So you can find me on Twitter at Gaius_Gracchus_. But more importantly, you can find my podcast on Twitter at Machete y Mate, right? You can download us on any podcasting platform, Apple, Spotify, whatever it is, where we're all on that. And once again, we focus on Latin American content from an English perspective, leftist content from an English perspective, that is. So if you're curious about that, if you enjoyed this conversation, I encourage anybody to check out my podcast. You can find us on TikTok too, if you're into that sort of thing. Oh. So that's fun. And also, I do a lot of work with the DSA, so I feel compelled to plug them really quick as well. So
cool. Austin, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you both so much.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah, he's great. I was on, I didn't mention actually, I don't think when he was on, but I was on Kenzo Shibata's Class Time Twitch stream with Austin. And yeah, very smart guy. I was not lying about binging those current events episodes. They are extremely well done. They have a really good rapport, those guys.
No, that was a lot of fun. I really appreciated that. And I love Kenzo's show too. It's like the part of the interruption of the left.
Yeah, literally. I made that reference and then it slowly occurred to me that this is literally the
idea. Yeah.
What should we move to now, David?
So we just have to talk about the big disappointments that we've seen this past couple of weeks from the Democratic Party, because it's frustrating to sit here in what is it March 4th, 2021, still without the necessary coronavirus stimulus and protections for people. It's extremely frustrating to sit here and watch the Republican Party double down on their like death politics, right? Which is essentially what, you know, Abbott's policy in Texas is, right? It's just cause mass suffering, right? And it's frustrating to try to talk to people about, you know, one, why that's wrong, but also not be able to point out that, like, not only do we say, like, we need to do these restrictions to help people to make sure that this disease doesn't spread, but we also are, you know, pushing forward this bold program to make sure that people aren't suffering for it, and that we can, that people, God forbid, might not suffer financially because of the continued coronavirus restrictions, but my God, might even come out of it on the other side a little bit better off. And what we've seen from the Democratic Party, this Biden administration, is a complete refusal to do that, not even on their own terms. This, the fact that we're not getting $2,000 checks like they campaigned on in Georgia, right? Now those have been walked back to $1,400. And this even more ridiculous additional restrictions that they've put on the $1,400 checks. At this point, the Democratic Party is spending all their time negotiating against themselves. Mm-hmm. and you saw that with this $1,400 checks, which I have to be a bit emotional about it, because it is unforgivable that we're sitting here a year out from the crisis and we're still not even going to get the bill that we should have gotten in March of 2020, right? That we're fighting to make sure that they uphold the basic promises that they made just a couple months ago. And the fact that we're not getting what we deserve is, look, the Republicans are evil. They are horrible. We understand that. But the Democrats, and specifically Joe Biden, and this group of people who is now in control of that party, love the Republicans as an excuse, so much so that they are actively actually negotiating against themselves without even having the Republicans in the room. And you can see that.
I just want to say there was a Republican who said something like, you know, we don't want to give people so much that when we reopen things, there's nobody working in the stores. And because fundamentally, this is about labor coercion, right? And like you said about the Democrats, this is a bipartisan agreement to make sure people have to serve a capitalist or the capitalist state in order to, you know, survive in this country. And yet, absolutely, like, that is a concern shared. That Republican was dumb enough to express it. The Republican Party is extra dangerous because they get a Democratic imprimatur for shit like this. And they can act like somehow this is, like, Greg Abbott can, you know, point to his base and be like, this is what people want. But absolutely, that people cannot, like, there was so much made out of, like, even what we got last year being too much to, like, get people back to work. And it was, like, the when the pandemic was still, like, new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, the second part of this is what they've done with $15 an hour.
Yes.
Right? And honestly, like two middle fingers to every asshole who sat there towards the end of the Democratic primary trying to act like Joe, when we said, you know, they come to me like, well, actually Joe Biden supports all of these progressive policies. Watch every single one of them, how he has walked back on them, just like we said that he would, right? Because that's the only politics that he knows. And that's the politics that has put him into the position that he is right now, which is to be a complete drooling imbecile, right? Just completely incompetent, and be the president of the United States, because they know he is a perfect little figurehead for this kind of politics, right? You can say one thing and then never deliver, right? And we have to just continue not trying to push Biden left. Like, stupid. That's not happening. Mm-hmm. And honestly, there's a lot of people who should be really embarrassed for putting out pieces trying to compare a Biden to some kind of, you know, this progressive moment that Biden was going to step into, right? I'm sorry. That was a bad call. People who are making that have been proven to be dead wrong, right? So we're not talking about pushing Biden left. We're trying to make it very clear to people that what Biden represents is not the like left alternative to GOP death drive politics, right? That Joe Biden, in fact, is very much a part of those politics that continue to make people suffer. And this fact, what's happened with $15 an hour, which is a very clear opportunity for them to put this through, right?
A campaign promise that was so in the bag that, not to relitigate, but Force the Vote voters said, like, let's not push him. We don't need to push him on $15 because he already said he's for that. And immediately, all of a sudden, this parliamentarian, which Kamala Harris could replace, is telling.
What the fuck is a parliamentarian?
The amazing thing is we talk about this two-party system and, like, wouldn't it be great if we had a parliamentary system? And we still have a fucking parliamentarian, though, who can stick their nose out and be like, actually, no, we can't do a $15 minimum wage. Go F yourself. Says who? Yeah. What are you going to do, parliamentarian? Are you going to throw me in jail?
Also, they can just ignore them. Like, literally, right, exactly. one thing that we talk about, we've talked about a lot on the show with people like Matt Carp, for example, with things like the Supreme Court, is so much about politics, especially in the United States, is actual decisions about saying, when Lincoln, for example, refused to accept rulings from the Supreme Court that were going to uphold slavery after he abolished it in the country, right? And he said to them, thank you so much, Supreme Court, for your legal advice. We're going to do this anyway, right? The same thing goes with the parliamentarian who has been overruled throughout American history when presidents say, oh, you know what? Thank you so much for your perspective on the mechanics of Congress. Right, we're going to do this because I'm the president. We're the ruling party, and we have the power to do it. So this kind of nonsense, just like desire to worship at the feet of any kind of rules or rule book that like liberals love to do, is something that is one an annoying personal tick, but in this context. Actually has severe human consequences, right? And that's something that you have to hold them to, is that the other side is not playing by those rules, that they're going to sit there and say, oh, the parliamentarian said that we can't strip away voting rights from all the people in the United States. We're going to obey that. No, they're going to do what they want to do because the Republicans are going to say, we have the presidency, we have the Senate, like they did under Trump. Now Biden has the power. Literally, the excuses that they are making are nonsensical. They are upholding the systems and the people who are preventing them from doing what they said they wanted to do in the first place.
Yeah, people like to talk about Manchin and co. and like cinema as if they're like, oh, damn it, just get on Biden's side. And as far as I'm concerned, they are the exact same body as Joe Biden. Like until you pass the PRO Act or the $15 minimum wage or any of these promises, like this idea that you are going to get stuck in procedural hurdles because of these people, you're picking a side, right? Like,
I mean, 100%. And to act like only Manchin can play politics is BS. Manchin is somebody just like anyone else who is movable. You start pressuring Manchin in West Virginia, right? You start running ads, going on local radio shows, all those kind of things, right? As a Democratic Party saying, hey, y'all remember how we were telling you to vote for Joe Biden and do all this because he was going to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Well, we want to do that, but Manchin is the reason that we couldn't, right? Like, you can do that.
Easy.
You have the opportunity to do that, and Manchin would be very, very worried about that. He's somebody – he's only tough because he knows the people on the other side have no bite behind their bark, right? That's it. And that's the cold, calculated, like, political understanding that Manchin – I'm sorry, this guy is not a political genius. This is not some reincarnation of Machiavelli. This is somebody who at least who knows that the people who he's up against are toothless. And he understands better than most, actually, that the people that he's up against are toothless, not just because, oh, Biden's so weak and blah, blah, blah. Because he knows that fundamentally Biden is not that committed to doing any of these things, right? So Biden's, he knows he has the best hand.
His closest His closest friend in the Senate is Chris Coons, who like literally was pondering whether it was smart to let women vote two or three years ago. Like, yeah, I think even like the hope that Biden would be a sort of weather vane or windsock for the party, I think are wrong, already proven wrong. I mean, look, if he passes the PRO Act or the $15 gets in the next reconciliation bill, but like, why talk about it as if he's already done it? Why give any credence to like rhetoric about this stuff? Because especially once you've seen, I mean, just to bring up immigration, he started off with all these sorts of like large press releases saying we're going to put a moratorium on deportations and we're going to go back to Obama's enforcement priorities, for instance. And even those things, which frankly, the bare minimum, weren't, had asterisks with them, like, oh, we're going to retain, we're going to still do deportations, actually, because we can't fully stop that. And also, I don't know what there's to say.
I mean, look, I think there's like a couple, you know, I think one understanding that it doesn't matter what people say on the campaign trail, like especially Democrats, right? It really doesn't. They will say whatever they think is easy, and then they will come up with every excuse, right? Because if it's not the parliamentarian, then it's the filibuster, or it's some other kind of procedural rule, right? Whatever it is, there's always something that is going to stop the Democrats from doing what they say. They've done it. They did it under Obama, and they're doing it again with Biden, right? And it's because they fundamentally don't want to see a shift, because these aren't even class focused. We talk about the distinction with social strategy between being class focused and class oriented. These aren't even class focused parties. You know, the only class that they're interested in focusing on is this $150,000 a year cohort that they have decided is the future of the Democratic Party, right? They are not going to sit out here and fight for working people, which means, I'm sorry, like, we don't have the option to sugarcoat things. It means the only thing that we can do is continuing to build our own independent power. Because if we have to rely on Joe Biden, if we have to rely on Manchin, if we have to rely on these cowards who will stab you in the back every time, we will never get done what needs to be done. And the tasks that we have to accomplish are huge. We can't play around with this nonsense anymore, right? Look, I think it's perfectly valid to say the Republicans and the Democrats are different, you know, organizations. So you can make, you know, tactical voting decisions based on that. But we can't let people lull themselves with that rhetoric into this false complacency that one of these things, that any action that you take in that moment is going to have fundamental difference. Because the most dangerous thing about this Biden presidency is that Sleepy Joe is sort of bleeding into the rest of the country, where people are tuning out, right? There was all this, you know, uproar about kids in cages, and now people are making defenses of that system, right? There was all this uproar about Donald Trump's aggressive foreign policy, and we have seen increased aggression from Joe Biden and increased aggression against, you know, Venezuela, for example, right? These things continue, and we need to make sure that people are aware of these things and don't get into this, you know, this false reality where they think that the Democratic Party is somehow going to address these systems, these problems more systematically just because they're a little bit nicer, right? Yeah. Like, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, like, frankly, the best thing about Hillary winning in 2016 is we wouldn't have to have this, you know, period of, oh my God, these guys suck, don't they? Yeah. Here we are.
Do you want to do the bum steer of the week?
Okay, yeah. So the bum steer of the week is going to... bum steer... Interesting little phrase. David tells me that Texas Tribune?
Texas
Monthly does a bum steer of the week. Now, that phrase originally is a seafaring phrase.
Mm-hmm.
But what I like about it is it's got both, like, kind of the coastal and also, like, country connotations to it. Because there's, like, you know, your bum steer of a ship's wheel, or you get me a bum steer because we're doing a cattle deal. Mm-hmm. Anyway, all that is to say, the first it basically means bad take, and maybe we'll do a little animation for it. But this week's bad take is Michael Moore. Could have been Keith Olbermann, but frankly, I don't expect much better from Keith Olbermann.
He's a psycho.
He's a psycho person. Mike Olbermann, I'm trying to scroll through Twitter and find the tweet while I do that. Michael Moore did this though too, and I just want to put this up. It's this thing we were talking about not making, for instance, the energy problems in Texas a blue state, red state thing, because I mean it's. Talk about the identity politics of identifying as a person from a state because of the way it votes in presidential elections is very insane, but like extremely, extremely pronounced and kind of horrifying. I'm trying to have a little bit of trouble. He definitely wouldn't have deleted it, I think, but...
Oh, no. Yeah, I mean, Michael Moore had a pretty chicken shit comment.
Got it.
You have it right here. And there's a lot here that's pretty good. Can you read it?
Yeah, I got it here. So he says, Texas, we hear you. You didn't want to be part of our electrical grid, and now you've removed your mask mandate and are allowing large crowds to gather. We hear you. COVID is a hoax, so you don't need our precious vaccine. We'll send it to people who are saving lives by wearing masks. The only thing I want to focus in on before you go, David, is that precious vaccine emphasis. That is a bad attitude to be putting out into the world with a major platform that we have a scarcity of this shit. Because guess what? No, we are making it, frankly, fast enough. That's one good thing that's happened by governance lately. We're not distribution is the problem. And whether we're going to adequately distribute it to everybody is the question. So saying there's some sort of scarcity and we're going to not give you our precious vaccine is awful. But anyway, David, go on.
Oh, I mean, it's absolutely disgusting. I would add that I didn't realize that the people who invented the vaccine were bloated people from Michigan, right? So it's like, what the hell is he talking about his vaccine to decide who gets it, right? Completely, completely obnoxious. And it reveals a really nasty liberal attitude that's not just about the United States in general, but it's like when the New York Times wrote their op-ed about COVID diplomacy and how we could use the vaccine to get what we want, right? It's amazing that people who think that they're more enlightened than others, right? Politically and spiritually, whatever, right? Because they vote blue no matter who, are so willing to use a tool to prevent mass death to further their certain political interests. It's completely despicable. And somebody like Michael Moore, who ostensibly is somebody who's trying to fight for common people, it's ridiculous to write off a huge state filled with millions and millions of working class people. It's ridiculous to honestly say that people should not get a vaccine based on if they vote Republican or Democrat in the first place.
It's casually exterminationist. I mean, and all that sort of rhetoric of like, oh, you don't have power, you don't have heat. Like, people don't understand how sociopathic they are being. I honestly don't think.
It's extremely sociopathic. and I'll also just say, it's like, look, again, the state grid is a problem in Texas. There's no doubt about it. I'm not putting that off the hook. But this is a classic example of what happens with these national narratives of like this was a severe crisis that happened in Texas. And it was a crisis that was made much worse by the fact that Texas is separated from the national grid. But the fundamental crisis was years and years and years of disinvestment for profit-seeking entities to make as much money off of electricity production in the state of Texas as possible, right? And all these things come out of it. But again, to sit there and say like, oh, well, the problem is that Texans are just too independent, right? It's just such a stupid way to look at that issue, right? Again, these are included, but it's like, it's a really simplistic way to avoid ever talking about the real issues, which are we have infrastructure across this country that has just been disinvested in for years and years and years by neoliberals, Republican and Democrat, right? I don't know, man. It's just like it infuriates me. Michael Moore should definitely know better than this.
He should. I mean, this is like I haven't been doing this professionally a decade, and even I know immediately like that is reactionary. That is you are this reactionary ideation. Go ahead.
Oh, no, keep going. I'm going to pull it up.
Well, when you start blaming people Like, and you're focused, you're looking down the wrong end of the fucking telescope. And like, it bothered me when after Trump won that you'd get these cars like, America just deserves this. It's like, who is this for? I don't know. What is this serving? It's like a personal little story you're telling yourself to make you feel better than other people, not to actually make those, like, lives better for people who are actually like suffering because of it.
So, but this is the thing about like the yellow belly thing that Michael Moore ends up doing is he goes on and he creates this thread. If you go on his,
I tried to find it, but he didn't thread it correctly.
He didn't thread it because he did it after the fact. After the fact, he tries to act like this is all part of some thread that didn't get included. And the thread is no better. He says like, oh, all the people saying it's the governor, like you have to impeach him, don't complain to me, impeach your governor. It's like,
okay, I'll do it after work.
Remember when you were just blowvating for years and years and years about impeaching, you know, Donald Trump? It's like I hate this idea that it's just like a question of will, right? And someone's going to sit there and be like, oh, you know what? Michael Moore just convinced me. And like now we're going to impeach the government. It's like, hell yeah, I'd like to impeach Greg Abbott. I'd like to like rid the state house of all of these lunatics. I don't know. It's just like it's such an unhelpful contribution to the conversation. But then it gets better because you know, he talks about how bad coronavirus is in Houston, right? It's like, well, thank you so much for reminding this again. And then he does this classic liberal thing. It's like, Texas is no longer majority white. The majority is Latinx and Black and Asian and Native American. So let's do everything we can to help that majority remove the bigots and ignoramuses from office. It's killing them and it's killing us. Again, it's just like stupid.
Fuck the poor whites, I guess.
This doesn't fuck everybody because it's just like, look, we're sitting here watching after all these bold pronouncements that Joe Biden was going to sweep the state of Texas, and we're seeing that those communities aren't even showing up as strongly for the Democratic Party anymore. And it's like, instead of sitting back and maybe, you know, wondering why that's happening, this kind of disgusting moral grandstanding, we're saying like, oh, you know, you're okay, but I want to kill your neighbor. Right. It's like, it's not a very, very attractive message to a lot of people. And it's really hard for, I think, especially people in other parts of the country to understand like that kind of like politics is not really attractive to folks to say, we're going to sit here and say that, like, anyways, I don't know. It's not a winning ticket. And we're not seeing any evidence that it's a winning ticket. The people who that plays the best with are rich white people who like it because they feel morally superior to their neighbors, which is what Adolf Reed said. Most of the Democratic Party politics are, by the way, it's just trying to feel morally superior to your Trump supporting neighbor. Right.
Yeah. And I love the appeal is just just incoherent to me. Like telling Texans who are dealing with like a maskless energy problems to impeach their governor. It's like that, how the Democrats are like, oh, if you want the minimum wage, just impeach the, or just end the filibuster. It's like, motherfucker, that's not my job. I can't get on the subway and go end the filibuster. Go ahead.
I just want to say this again, right? The move by Abbott to basically reopen the state is going to have devastating human consequences, right? And it's something that we all have to oppose. It's been frustrating to see what has immediately happened with this, where it's like, you know, some businesses are going to follow the rule and some aren't, right? Which is just creating, you know, just a chaos, situation within communities, because it's really, you know, drawing fine lines between like, okay, this is a establishment that's going to follow the COVID rules and this establishment that's not, right? Which means that people are waging battle in a way that I don't find to be the most productive, especially when what you do to beat people like Abbott and people who want to refuse to provide the basic restrictions that are needed to make sure that we don't see a massive jump in COVID cases is to not just focus on the restrictions, but also to provide a better alternative, which means paying people to stay home, providing them with healthcare, all of these things to say, we're not just the movement that's saying stay at home, you know, and suffer and don't go to work, you know, and deal with the consequences of that. We're the group of people saying like, we want communities to survive this horrible pandemic. So here's a plan that includes payments and healthcare and all these things that are needed to make this as comfortable as humanly possible. This horrible, obviously uncomfortable situation. We're going to do our best to make this as comfortable for people as possible. Like, if you don't provide them with that, you give people like Abbott like a huge opportunity, because if people wouldn't ever want to be on Abbott's side if it was, you know, if it was, oh, go and, you know, deal with this pandemic and potentially expose yourself constantly by not having any restrictions. If the alternative was, yes, we're going to have social distancing and all this other stuff, but we're also going to make sure that people are getting paid and getting extra money in their pocket. Like, that's the other thing too about like people who are against this, like $1,400 checks, saying like, oh, well, some people don't need it. It's like, well, you know, it actually is good to say that, like, we're going to make this a somewhat positive experience for people to encourage them to follow these rules. So, you know, so if you refuse to do that kind of politics, like if Michael Moore was very serious about trying to address the problem that we just saw there, why don't you push Joe Biden to show up with an actual, you know, stimulus package that includes more direct help for working people, like make that option more attractive instead of just trying to convince millions and millions of people that this really horrible self-sacrificial aspect of a necessary solution, but it's not something that's very popular or very fun. Like, nobody enjoys this, right? Give them something better to include with wearing the mask and the social distancing. It's just like, it's really easy politics.
Yeah.
And they won't do it.
Nope. Yeah.
I don't know, man.
Yeah, it is. It sucks. It really sucks. Folks, we will see you in the post game. We'll take some of your Discord questions, have a few other things for you. Sorry we weren't live last week, but I think luckily it looks like we're back this week with no
back in the saddle
issues. So, David, thank you very much.
All right, brother. I'll see you on the other side.
All right. We'll see you guys in about a half hour or so.